Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We are your hosts, Matt Levine
and Vincent Hannum.
And we are talking about all of our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy. We're asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts are welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by BanditsEmporium.com, where you can shop exclusive monster-inspired t-shirts with part of the proceeds supporting this show. So yeah, tonight we have a very special guest to welcome to the show, Ben Cook Feltz. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you. Happy to be here.
Welcome, Ben. So happy to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Ben, can you talk a little bit about your history with kaiju movies and why you wanted to join the podcast?
Sure thing. I am, for all intents and purposes, a lifelong kaiju fan. Ever since the age of 7, I first got introduced via King Kong, specifically King Kong Lives, which if that's your introduction into the world of kaiju, everything, you is nowhere but up after that. And wow. Very quickly, my love of King Kong expanded to my love of all things Godzilla. And I spent about 3 years from grades 2 to 4 just collecting as many Godzilla VHS cassettes as I could, and watching a lot of movies. At the time, there was something called Super Scary Saturday on TBS every Saturday morning. I don't know if you're familiar, but it was this wonderful program where Grandpa Munster would introduce, like the actual Grandpa Munster would introduce a classic horror movie, and there were a whole bunch of Godzilla movies and Universal monster movies and stuff that I got to see. And for some reason, the love has just stuck, and I remain a diehard kaiju fan to this day.
Oh my God, that is amazing. So many things to unpack. This is going to be the whole podcast episode right here. King Kong Lives?
Uh-huh. Hey, King, have you talked about that on this podcast yet?
Oh,
sadly, no.
Oh boy. It's a beauty.
I admittedly haven't seen it, but I know from what I've read, it's regarded as like the worst King Kong movie. What, just a terrible movie in general.
Oh,
right?
Oh yeah, by a long shot. I mean, there's been a massive critical redemption of the 76 remake, and that's one of my favorite movies of all time, but there's not much that can be said about King Kong Lives that's worth saving. I don't think it's I mean, I you know, an 8-year-old would love it, but it's a pretty ridiculous movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
If that's your intro to kaiju movies and you're like, yeah, I want more of this, that's like a sign that you're in like lifelong passion, you know?
Yep, exactly. Like it didn't matter what the plot was or how ridiculous everything seemed. Like I was just there and I loved it. So, yeah.
That's awesome. It's cool to hear about like the TBS series too. I vaguely remember that. And it's like, you know, I also think about like Joe Bob Briggs and Elvira and stuff like that. Like those things from our childhood that like get us into monster movies, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I love that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I have a, like, in a perfect world, if I could have anything I wanted, Camp Kaiju would be like one of those shows. Just because, like, I love that so much. You have a host and there's characters involved and there's bits involved, but then you just like watch the movie and then talk about it. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. And then it goes back to the host. And especially with someone like Joe Bob, you could just tell that he genuinely loved all of those movies. And like something about that enjoyment was so pure and addictive that it just kind of made you more interested in watching whatever it was that he was showing. And yeah, great stuff.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. MST3K too, even though they ridiculed the movies the whole time, they like simultaneously loved them, you know? So
yeah,
that was one of my big entryways into monster movies also.
Sure. No, absolutely.
You seem like a perfect guest to talk about the movie Mothra from 1961, which is going to be our focus today. Thanks also to everybody out there listening, to all of our friends and patrons. We really appreciate you. Thank you for supporting the podcast. Please rate and review wherever you listen. You can also share this podcast with a friend. We always appreciate that. You should also check out our website and Patreon. Our website, CampKaijuMovieReviews.com. We have extra special movie reviews, particularly for our patrons. So we want to thank you again, Kelly, Chris, Frank. So what do we have coming up here? We have our Frozen with Fear Patreon series. Vincent, do you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, just real briefly, it's our three-part limited series just for patrons. We got a $3 tier, $5 tier, $10 tier, $15 tier. Either one you choose, you're going to get access to this three-part series diving into Antarctic monster movies, starting with Alien versus Predator. We just dropped that episode a week ago. And then we're going to follow it up with not one, but two things. 2011's The Thing and 1982's The Thing. That is patreon.com/campkaiju. So links in the bio. That's there for you to enjoy.
Very, very exciting. Our special guest hosts, we've always, you know, over the past couple episodes, we've invited them to swing the gamma gong in honor of our patrons. So Ben, tonight the honor is yours.
Great, thank you.
Have at it.
And swing.
Awesome. Even better than I thought it would be.
It's so resonant.
Yeah.
My ears are ringing. Yeah. Thank you, Ben. That was awesome.
Oh, my pleasure.
Here in the month of March, we have Mothra March Madness. We'll have some brackets featuring various Mothra movies. So all of our social media followers, in the comments, let us know what you think wins each round. And we'll keep you posted with the results throughout the month of March.
And I have a surprise for you two. I've come up with some trivia questions that you two can compete for.
Oh, my.
We'll do that at the break with the Bandits Emporium spot. I'll hit you with some Mothra trivia.
Cool. What's the prize for this trivia?
The prize is a printed out Mothra March Madness bracket. So you'll get your own poster bracket, as well as each Patreon. This is kind of a pledge drive too for Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/campkaiju between now and April, you get your own Mothra March Madness bracket.
That sounds pretty great.
Yeah. I'm way more invested in this upcoming trivia now. At first I was like, we'll see what happens. Now I want to win this.
Now this means war.
Yeah, exactly.
I do want to say, last thing we'll say about Patreon, the money we get, we do try to give back to our patrons. Really, it's all for you, so we can't do it without you.
So let's start with the personal histories with the film. Ben, what is your history with Mothra?
My history goes back almost as early as King Kong Lives. I'm pretty sure that I got a VHS copy of Mothra when I was in second grade, so Christmas 88. I will say that it's not a movie that I watched a lot when I was a kid. I mean, I liked it. I was definitely very much, if Godzilla wasn't in it or a Gargantua wasn't in it, I probably wasn't going to watch it all the time. But it's a movie that I definitely liked. And the older I've gotten, the more I've come to appreciate Mothra. Not necessarily as the movie itself, but just what it represented in just the history of Japanese monster movies and how much influence I think it ended up wielding. So I think it's a very important movie for anyone who's into Japanese monsters or giant monsters in general to watch. I'll come back to it from time to time.
Ben, you came to it a lot sooner than I did. This movie in particular, Mothra, the character, has always been my favorite kaiju.
Oh, wow.
Godzilla versus Mothra. That was like my favorite Godzilla movie.
Same here. Yeah.
So I was always curious about the one that started it all.
Right.
Mothra's first appearance. I only saw it last year for the first time. Found it. It was just a fascinating movie. The visuals, I was like, this doesn't always make sense, but like, does it have to? It's just shot so well. I was really impressed by it. I came back to it for this episode a couple weeks ago. There's just a lot of things to talk about and think about.
Absolutely. Yeah.
How about you, Matt?
Really, I was very much looking forward to it because I loved Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster, which I just watched last year for the first time. We talked about that on an episode of the podcast. Really, really loved it. And the stuff with Mothra and the Shobeen, the twin fairies, were just like so mind-bogglingly weird to me and like unexpected and surreal. I was like, I need to watch everything Mothra as soon as possible. So I've been looking forward to this for quite a while, ever since seeing Ghidorah. I've never seen Mothra versus Godzilla, so I'm really excited to watch that and talk about that in a couple weeks as well.
Yeah, I think it's good to like start with the first one. It's a good introduction to the character. I think the character grows stronger in subsequent movies, but like this is the classic Mothra. All the tropes are established in this film.
I actually think that even more so than the original Godzilla, I think that the original Mothra is the most influential Toho monster movie. I mean, I think it's the first one. All the ones before it are great, but they do sort of follow your standard science fiction tropes. The anything from Godzilla, Rodan, or Varan or anything, it's basically, it could probably have been made by a different studio in a different country, but Mothra is the first time where it's like very, very Japanese in all the wonderful ways. And it's just so weird. Like, you know, imagine trying to pitch this story to a studio executive in the United States in 1960, and you'd be laughed out of the room, you know, but that's what makes it so delightful and so wonderful, but it's just so gloriously weird.
Yeah. Like I could debate the logic of this, but I'm just going to go with it, you know?
Yeah. No, you can't.
In the original story that was published as a serial in a newspaper in Japan, there was a pretty extensive like mythology and backstory for the Shobijin and for Mothra and like the whole kind of foundations of the cosmology on the island. And then the screenwriter Sekizawa in writing the screenplay was like, we're just going to cut all that, like focus on the kaiju, just entertainment, we don't want to confuse audiences. So I would like to read that original story at some point, but it's definitely not in the movie.
I was just thinking that when we were recording this, that like, I know that it's based on a much larger treatment, but I've never read the treatment. I'm sure it's available somewhere, but
I'd hope so.
To kind of continue the kaiju movie all-star roster that we have here, it's produced by Tomoyuki Tanaka, who produced all the Godzilla films from 1954 to 1995. We have cinematography by Hajime Koizumi, who also shot King Kong versus Godzilla, Atragon, Ghidorah, Invasion of the Astro Monsters, many others. Personally, we kind of already touched on this, but the bright, beautiful, colorful cinematography is maybe my favorite part of this movie. It looks incredible.
Yeah. Especially all the sequences on Infant Island. I think they're just marvelous.
Oh, yeah. Really psychedelic and surreal, just like eye-popping, you know?
Yeah.
And the jungles are so dark and menacing, too.
Yeah. The moment when like they rise over the hill and they see this like great expanse of like a green forest beneath them.
Yeah.
Stunning, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we also have special effects by Eiji Tsuburaya. Tsuburaya, again, is kind of synonymous with the Godzilla character and franchise and series. He did, you know, the majority of the suit work and special effects for the classic Toho kaiju films. We have a music by Yuji Koseki. So this is maybe one of the cases where one of the all-stars of the kaiju films, Akira Ifukube, was not back for this movie. One of my favorite elements of this movie is Mothra's song, which the Shobijin sing in a very memorable scene, and is just maybe the catchiest movie song I have ever heard. I love Mothra's song so much. And I feel like I've been annoying the hell out of my partner because I've been whistling that nonstop for the last day, so it's probably going to go on for a lot longer.
Yeah. Can I just say, I know that I'm probably breaking the rules here too, but there's something so beautifully demented about Mothra's song just being what it is, that here they are performing for these unsuspecting people that are like, oh, this is so cute, these tiny people are singing, and they're pleading to their god to come destroy the town and rescue them.
I thought the same thing. I was like, oh, this is lovely, oh god, they're summoning death upon us.
And it's like maybe one of the few cases from a kaiju film around this time where like, well, I don't know, we do want the destruction to happen because it like looks awesome and it looks, you know, like so cool and amazing and stylish. But in this case, there's like a moral reason to like want the attack to happen, you know, for them to like go back to their rightful home so this capitalist can stop exploiting them. Musical duo consisting of twin sisters Emi and Yumi Ito. Very well known and very popular in Japan at the time this movie came out, so it was definitely a big draw for Mothra, or for audiences to go see Mothra at the time.
Well, I think it, yeah, like, if you can imagine them being like these pop stars, you throw them into your big budget kaiju movie, like, what would be the equivalent today? Just,
I don't know, Ed Sheeran in a Marvel movie. I don't know.
Yeah, where he sings and performs.
Right. I'm the ambassador for Captain America, even though I'm not American, but I'm going to sing a song.
I don't know if I would love that or hate that. It sounds terrible, but also just like bizarrely amazing at the same time.
If Ed Sheeran was 12 inches tall.
Okay, I would love it. Yeah. That's...
Then yeah, you'd love it.
Kidnap 12-inch Ed Sheeran and he must sing.
All right. So BanditsEmporium.com is the official t-shirt partner of Camp Kaiju. Check out BanditsEmporium.com or hit the link in our bio to check out their selection of monster-inspired tees. Part of the proceeds goes to supporting this very show. You can visit BanditsEmporium.com. Again, whatever your style, they have you covered. As they say, we sell shirts. As Camp Kaiju says, it's Mothra March Madness! And I got some trivia questions for Ben and Matt.
Oh boy.
Oh yeah, let's do this.
So I think the format I have in my mind, we can play with it, but like it's like multiple choice. And I'm gonna hit Ben with a multiple choice question.
Okay.
And then if you get it wrong, Matt can steal.
Okay.
And then I'll hit Matt with the multiple choice question and the same. And then there's a third one. So like I guess if there's a tie, you can have a bit of a tiebreaker. Okay, Ben, you're up first.
All right.
Okay. So we were talking about the serialized novel that Mothra first appeared in, titled what? Weird Tales of New Kirk City? The Luminous Fairies and Mothra? Mothra, the Ugly Butterfly? Or Mothra and the Infant Island Babies?
B.
The Luminous Fairies and Mothra. You are correct.
Hey.
Yeah.
Okay, Matt. In 1962, Columbia Pictures released Mothra in the United States on a double bill with what prestigious film? Is it Abbott and Costello Go to Mars? The Three Stooges in Orbit? The Laurel Hardy Murder Case? Or the Elvis classic Girls, Girls, Girls?
I will go with B, The Three Stooges in Orbit.
You are correct.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, Smarty Pants, I bet you can't get this one. So I'll throw it to Ben. The largest species of moth in the world is the Atlas moth, native to Southeast Asia. What is the approximate wingspan of the Atlas moth? Is it 6 inches, 10 inches, 24 inches, or 48 inches?
I'm going to say 24 inches.
Okay. Matt, what say you?
I was going to say the same thing, but now I feel like I have to guess something else, just to make it interesting. So, I'm going to say 48 inches.
Well, you are both incorrect. The answer is 10 inches. Yeah, there are no giant moths that big out in the world. 10 inches sounds big enough. So it's a tie. You both get a poster bracket for Mothra March Madness.
Awesome.
I will hang it lovingly.
So remember, you all can also visit patreon.com/campkaiju to receive your own Mothra March Madness poster.
All right. In 1960, producer Tomoyuki Tanaka hired three writers, Shinichiro Nakamura, Takehiko Fukunaga, and Zene Hata, to write the story The Luminous Fairies and Mothra, the answer which Ben just gave in the trivia, as the source for this film. The story was serialized in Weekly Asahi Extra magazine. However, in the process of adapting the story into the screenplay, a lot of it was changed. The original story had a lot of mythological backstory of Infant Island, which included some Christian-like iconography and the origins of the Shobijin, the immortal fairies who are dedicated to serving Mothra. The original story also had a political subplot that alluded to a then-controversial security treaty between Japan and the United States. We definitely do still have some themes in the film of Japanese-U.S. relations, not to mention, with the Soviet Union as well. But a lot of that was cut out from the original story in the process of adapting it. I also read that Zenei Hata included an anti-discrimination theme based on a person's size. Presumably that was connected to the Shobijin characters. But that also was cut from the finished screenplay.
The movie as it stands, I think, is a pretty great story. Like, I think all the things that were taken out, those were the right things to take out in the service of the movie.
Right. It seems like more lore and world building, which at the end of the day, you can cut out and maybe save and explore in those sequels if you wanted to.
And I sort of think that kind of world building maybe works better sometimes in literature than in film, just because on film, what you see is so convincing. You're just like, yeah, I believe that this exists and it's a real world and all that. Like, I feel like you almost don't need to go into all that background because if you have enough suspension of disbelief, you can be convinced that this is really happening, you know?
Yeah. And especially the subplot stuff about, Japan and the United States. I mean, even when I was 7 years old, there was no mistaking what Rolissica actually was supposed to be or what New Kirk City represents. That comes through.
Totally. Yeah, for sure. I feel like if it went more into that, it would start to be like, we get it. You're starting to preach to us now a little bit. But as it is in the movie, it's great. I love just the bluntness of that critique. Any more of it might be a little bit too much.
It's interesting to me, changing topics slightly, that Honda kind of had a wish that this would be turned into a Disney movie. And he certainly wanted to present it as that kind of fantasy, family-oriented movie.
I think it is. It's clearly, I think it would be fun and exciting for kids to watch. Overall, I think there's a tone of fun and levity and whimsy and stuff like that. There's even that ridiculous little kid character who's wearing the baseball cap who goes in to rescue the Shobijin.
I'd almost say this is a fantasy movie more than a science fiction movie, other than the fact that there are allusions to atomic bombs and a few things. But I mean, that wouldn't even be necessary for the story to still work.
Yeah, which is what makes it so different from Gojira or Rodan, which are very much rooted in a horror tone, I feel like. And if you come to Mothra expecting that, you're going to be disappointed, or you're going to be confused because you're like, oh, this is a more of a family fantasy film.
Right.
Which works for it.
Yeah, definitely. I wonder how much of that was the influence of, again, the screenwriter Sekizawa, who, again, kind of prioritized just lightness and fun and entertainment more than some other writers of the kaiju movies.
Yeah.
I read that he and Honda, I don't want to say there was tension, but they kind of were going for different things a little bit, because Honda did want to include some of those anti-nuclear proliferation themes. He even had prepared a scene where Infant Island is partially destroyed by an atomic bomb blast, but that was cut out of the finished film.
Just maybe as a prelude or something like that?
I don't really know. You're right. I don't know where it would fit into this movie. It's probably for the best that was cut. especially, again, considering the light entertainment of it all, that would not fit in at all.
I feel as if this is not the first Honda movie where I've heard he had disagreements with the tone and the direction of the film. In when we covered Ghidra, the three-headed monster, is the same thing. He was like, I don't want my monsters to have human qualities because I want to take them seriously and not treat them like kid jokes.
Yeah.
And he just continually loses that argument. Someone higher than him, maybe Tanaka, is like, sorry, this is the direction the franchise is moving.
Well, in the biography, that does come up a lot, where, that was one of the differences between Honda and someone like Kurosawa, where Honda definitely had a strong vision and he was a very, firm director, but also he was a company player and he wanted, you know, he wanted to make people happy. So ultimately he would kind of go with whatever, yeah, someone higher up in the studio or Eiji Tsuburaya or anyone, whatever they would, what they really like felt passionately about, he would go along with it for the most part.
Which totally works too. That collaboration comes through. And you wonder if he was like more obstinate, would the franchise have lasted as long?
Honestly, like I love the Heisei Godzilla movies, the ones in the 90s, but they kept Godzilla the bad guy throughout. And there definitely is a little bit of repetition the further you go, where it's like, where do we go with these characters? And by contrast, like turning them weirder and human and then heroes to children. I mean, it's ridiculous, but it also, I think, kept the series going 10 years longer than it probably would have.
Yeah, that's so interesting, that kind of evolution.
And I think, yeah, like the tension between, you know, again, like the sort of darker elements and then this like bizarre, weird, surreal entertainment, like, you know, that's still one of the most interesting things about these movies. Like, they can't be like easily described as just like one or the other, you know? One of those cases where like producers meddling probably benefited the movie.
Ishiro, just direct the picture.
Right.
He's like, okay.
Fine.
And did an amazing job at it.
Yes, yeah. 100%. Oh, so committed. The sets mm-hmm. and the models, first and foremost, to me, really stood out in this movie.
Yes.
They were so detailed, I thought.
Yes.
And the scale was so perfect.
Yep.
With the caterpillar Mothra.
Yes.
I was like, oh my God. And then the way Honda shoots it, it's all from above. So much of it, which lends such a unique perspective, I feel like, that I don't often get in these movies from above. Yeah. When Mothra is swimming through the ocean, gorgeous.
Oh yeah, you're right. Yeah, yeah. I know that in this movie they didn't do this way in the other ones, but in this movie the larva costume was gigantic by other, you know, compared to other kaiju. But I think it was even more than two people. There was like a few people that were inside the costume, and because of that, they were able to build things on the models on a larger scale than usual. So the whole sequence of larva Mothra attacking is just, it's one of the best in Toho history, I think, because it's so, like you said, so beautifully filmed, so beautifully lit. And then just the details, like, I don't think I've ever seen as many just signs.
Yeah.
In a sequence. Yeah. And it's just so great. It just makes it all so much more realistic.
And then when Mothra builds her cocoon on the Tokyo Tower, first of all, that cocoon just looks so real to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was right. But like, yeah, I just can't say anything more about it.
Because it's like the signs in those sets, like I feel like we get such a distinct sense of like where Japan was at, sort of like in terms of like becoming a capitalist nation, as like so many nations throughout the world were in the 60s, you know. And like that was a big issue for Japan after World War II, like how can we be like a global competitor, like in global capitalism or whatever. So we see these signs for like Coca-Cola. I think there's like a there's like a gas station sign. I don't know if it's Esso or something like that. But like we, even though they're just model sets, we get like a really clear sense of like where Japan culture was at the time, you know?
It is. I've never thought about that, but you're absolutely right. I mean, that totally plays into the theme of the movie that, you know, very anti, you know, I don't know if it's anti-capitalism, but definitely anti-Western culture in a certain way, where it's like, you know, the Relisikans are, or Nelson in particular, is only focused on making money at all costs. And the fact that Mothra's demolishing, I'm sure it was no coincidence that Mothra's demolishing all these things and you see all these, you know, Western culture signs and stuff.
Yeah. And that's, you know, then eventually Mothra does go to Newkirk City and it's like, you know, the, what is that expression? The pigeons coming home to roost. I feel like that expression is kind of very appropriate for that, you know?
The giant moth coming home to roost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All the model set stuff is great. I feel like it's so vivid. And, you know, like there's a part where Mothra is flapping her wings and like we see a bunch of cars just like flying into the distance. And it's, you know, like convincing in the kind of like fantastic old school way where like you feel like you can like reach out and touch the cars and the buildings and stuff like that. And in my head, I was comparing it to a sequence in Shin Godzilla where there's like a mudslide and there's like CGI of like all these cars being swept away. And when I watched Mothra, I was like, I think I'd rather have the model sets. Like, it's maybe not more convincing than CGI, but it looks a lot cooler and more bizarre, I think, you know?
Well, it definitely captures your attention. Like, I just remember when Mothra's approaching, you know, and I can't remember, well, who knows what bridge it's supposed to be, either Golden Gate or Brooklyn, but there's a bridge and you see all those model cars just kind of driving by on it. And I took notice. I said out loud when I watched it last week, oh, that's really cool. Like, I don't know. Even if it's not realistic, you can see the craft and you're really drawn to it in a way that I wouldn't be if I was just seeing something that was, you know, CGI modern day.
We're just too desensitized to the CGI. The novelty of it's worn off. So if a movie were to be bold enough to go back to practical effects, then we'd be like, whoa, suddenly we're like hooked on this movie like we wouldn't be otherwise.
There's a Godzilla historian that I love named David Callett. He's done several commentaries for some of the movies and stuff, and he's a huge fan of specifically the goofier Godzilla movies. And, you know, a point that he brings up time and time again is, you know, one of the things that the criticisms is that these special effects aren't always realistic. And his response is, so what? Like, they look awesome, and that's not the point.
It's a movie about a giant monster.
Suspend your disbelief.
Yeah, and it, you know, I'd rather have something look interestingly fake than like blandly fake, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like every episode I have like my anti-CGI rant, and I sort of got it in on this one, so I feel better about myself now. I guess I'll just add that there were three versions of the adult, you know, the actual Mothra that were created. The largest size had a wingspan of 8 feet and light bulbs for eyes. All that stuff looks so cool, like the glowing blue eyes, you know, love that.
Oh yeah.
There was a mid-size Mothra that was created for the flying and the hatching scenes. The hatching scene is also pretty amazing. And then a small Mothra created for the long shots of whenever she is approaching Newkirk City. So yeah, you know, again, a lot of care went into the suits and the special effects, obviously. And, you know, I think by the time Mothra emerges from her cocoon and starts flying, it looks amazing. And like, you know, for me personally, I was like, all right, where are we going to go from here? Like the caterpillar is being kind of like just pelted with like military weapons and nothing is happening. And like, of course, the logical next step is, oh, she's going to fly. She's going to turn into a moth. And like, I should have obviously known that was going to happen, but it's so amazing when it does happen, you know?
I have some like really nitpicky qualms with some of the special effects. Now might be, I feel a little sacrilegious mentioning these, but damn it, I will. I felt like Tsuburaya went a little too, he leaned too far into the, for lack of a better word, like the toy aesthetic, like the, I hate calling them the toy tanks and stuff, but I just don't know what else to call them. You know, having the little model tanks is fine, but then he would include people on top of the tanks.
Yeah.
And it was the people that took me out of it. And then those scenes were juxtaposed with real footage of tanks and people, and it was just an incongruity that I was like, I'm not a fan of this looks a little too, I don't know, cheesy for me, because people are hard. And we saw it with the Shobijin themselves when they're picked up on Infant Island. They're clearly probably Barbie dolls.
They almost looked more like rag dolls. Like, they looked like their arms looked a little fluffy.
Something was going on with them.
Yeah.
But clearly not people. And a living organism is so hard to replicate as a model.
If we're being honest, the Newkirk City sequence is a little underwhelming. I think especially in the context of both the larva sequence, which is just so well done.
Mm-hmm.
The Newkirk City sequence just seems a little, it's not as good. It's a little more toy-like. And also, I mean, I would think that a lot of people that had seen Mothra had probably also seen Rodan. And those sequences with the flying and the wings are just so much better, more intricate. It's not bad, but it definitely doesn't wow me quite as much as the first sequence did.
Yeah, and it's hard to put a finger on it, right?
I think your criticisms of the special effects are all fair and valid. The non-kaiju stuff in this movie, all the human stuff, didn't work for me very well. Like, I thought it was relatively kind of like repetitive and dull. I mean, you know, it's with some exceptions, it's kind of a generalization. So I think whenever it gets into the kaiju stuff and when like we see Mothra flying around, I was just happy to have like any kind of monster on screen at all, basically. So I understand what you're saying, and I do think Rodan's effects are better, but yeah, it was like kind of like the boost and excitement that I needed in this movie, you know.
The ending sequence is extraordinary, with Mothra landing on the runway and everything. Like, that's very well shot and very creative.
It's glorious to see, like, to see the giant monster in relation to the little full-size people, right? It's a sense of scale, like a wide shot that you don't often see. Actually, there was a couple other shots like that when Larva Mothra is swimming, and there's just these wide shots where you see her in the midst of the ocean, and there's like jet planes flying overhead, and you just get a great sense of size. Like, this thing is mammoth.
And the great moment where she attacks the cruise ship as well. I love that shot. I also think it's kind of interesting that an alternate ending was also filmed for this movie. It was kind of an effort to save on the budget a little bit. So they filmed the alternate ending before the actual Newkirk City ending. So in the alternate ending, Nelson basically dies by falling into a volcano after Mothra like flaps her wings next to him, basically. The weird thing is that Toho had a contract with Columbia, where Columbia wanted a city that seemed American, that could like stand in for an American city in their collaboration. So that's why the Newkirk City scene had to be the ending of the film. Columbia demanded it.
Definitely interesting. I mean, I was assuming, thank you for explaining it a little bit better. I was just assuming that like Mothra comes over and attacks Newkirk City and, oh, there's this volcano right next to the city, and for some reason Nelson's up there. Like, how does that even work? But
yeah, I would not put it past a movie like this. But yeah, it was supposed to still be in Japan and not in Silica or Newkirk City. Yeah.
I mean, there is a trope in several of these movies where random volcanoes just seem to appear out of nowhere, and
or octopus.
Yeah.
You never know.
One of the two.
Ben, did you listen to our Frankenstein Conquers the World episode?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome. Well, we talked about briefly the scene of the atomic attack on Infant Island, which was cut probably for the better from the finished film. And yeah, I don't know if there's really too much more to say about the sort of nuclear anxiety theme in this movie beyond just the what new world are we in where this is like a fear that nations and people actually have to face, you know?
I'm comparing it to 1954 when Godzilla came out, where the nuclear thing was so clear and present. Like, that was clearly what the movie was warning us against. By 1961 with Mothra, I feel like, you know, in those 7 years, a innumerable amount of atomic radiated monster movies. So by 1961, I feel like it's more of a plot device at this point rather than like the warning. You know what I mean?
Even to the extent where like the scenes of people being evacuated because Mothra is coming, like, You know, I think in the original Godzilla and some other movies that came out shortly thereafter, like the immediate association probably would have been the atomic bombings. But by this time in 1961, it feels like more just a genre element than like based in reality, you know?
Right.
If not just atomic bombings, but just bombings in general, that at the t that is of 54, it hadn't even been 10 years since the end of World War II when fire bombings of Tokyo. I mean, like that was a regular thing for 3 years. So they were deliberately invoking that. Yeah, and by now it's just like, oh man, here comes another one.
That kind of national trauma maybe had it was still there, of course, but maybe it wasn't quite so like foremost on people's minds, you know?
Yeah.
The national trauma was still there, but I think we are moving into a new decade where kids are growing up and becoming adults now, and not quite having the same immediate memory as their parents did with the war. And this leads me into the next point about diplomatic relations between Japan, the US, and the Soviet Union. So the big, like, there's a social thing going on at this time with a new defense treaty that the United States and Japan were working on to replace the initial treaty after World War II, where the United States occupied Japan. By 1961, Japan was saying, we need a new treaty that you can guarantee us our defense. You
Yeah.
can give us more freedom, first of all. You can, like, stop occupying our country. And that treaty is still in effect today, but at the time it was very controversial, and young people especially were protesting against it, saying, why do we even need a relationship with the United States? Like, let's just have a clean break. I think Honda's aware of that. I think he's tapping into that social unrest towards the West.
On a similar level, and this is something that actually does that is addressed in the first Godzilla, is the sense that there was a fear at the time that would there become a conflict between the United States and the USSR, or were drop bombs to be dropped again and used in warfare. There was a legitimate fear that Japan would end up being like a staging ground, or that bombs would be dropped there to kind of like prove a point. And they're the only country that has still ever had atomic bombs used on them, and they were also the country that had the irradiated tuna. And in this movie, it's not a Japanese person that brings this chaos upon the country. It's a Rolisican. And, so they're just sort of innocent victims of what's happening.
Yeah, I think there's a moment where one of the characters is like paraphrasing what the Shobijin wants, where they say like, we don't want any more testing on our island. And then like later somebody says, take your atomic bombs to another island, like sort of summarizing what the Shobijin want. And it's like, well, that's what the movie is saying to the United States, basically, right?
Yeah.
Like, get your atomic bombs out of here. And
Yeah.
I admire like the directness and the kind of anger beneath that line, even though it is a very fun, like whimsical movie. There's like a little bit of anger behind it too, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I just think the character of Clark Nelson, which is like the most American name of all time, and how much of like a like an utter villain, like he should be
Oh.
twirling a mustache, if he had a
Yeah.
mustache.
That man had an amazing sneer. Like his smile, so sinister, like right from the start. It's like, oh, there's the bad guy.
A great evil laugh. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
It's all there for sure.
I'm sure in real life he was like the nicest guy. He probably like brought coffee and donuts every morning.
Plays a good villain, though. It's the
Yeah.
role he was meant to play. Like I read that Rulisica is supposed to be kind of like a combination of the United States and the Soviet Union, but like to the extent that like the name is even like a combination of like the Japanese pronunciation for the United States and the Soviet Union. But the way it plays out in the movie, like it is the United States. I feel like that's the only interpretation, you know?
Yeah.
And like just to, it's not only a satire of like American militarism and capitalism, but I think even like the entertainment industry, like Nelson obviously steals the Shobijin and then makes them into like a nightclub act, which is not what I expected at all. I thought they were going to be turned into a weapon of some kind. was like, whoa, this is a weirdly more like, it's like a deeper critique of American society than I thought it would be, you know?
Yeah, there's something so strange and I guess critical about the fact that they talk about this red juice that can cure radiation sickness. And it's just sort of dropped as soon as they get to the island. And it's like, you would think that that's what they would want to exploit, that they would like, you know, take that off the island and maybe like ruin them. But no, it's, I want to take the 6-inch Shobijin and have them sing and perform. It's just,
right.
To me, it's illogical, but it also just works perfectly.
I have a theme I wanted to throw in. The journalism aspect of this film intrigued me, and the ethics of having to report on something just because you see it. Frankie Sakai's Fukuda, he's the journalist who stows away and gets onto Infant Island, and he comes back and he agrees to not report on it for the sake of protecting the island.
Yeah.
And he has a great argument with his editor, who's like, what kind of journalist are you? Like, this is a great story. And I just thought that was a really insightful argument that they had.
It's even like kind of repeated in the joke that ends the movie, where like there's all this like dramatic mayhem with Mothra and the Shobijin, and then they fly back to Infant Island, and then the photographer realizes she forgot to take pictures of all of it, and that's like all she's wanted to do the entire movie, and she just forgot to take a picture of it. I don't know, it's just meant to be a joke, but I feel like it also does kind of like reflect that theme of like, you know, like honoring your subject so much that you don't actually cover it in the media, you know?
Right, because what's the line between, you know, covering something and exploiting something? Maybe some things are just left better left undisturbed.
There was one more theme that I wanted to bring up as well, which is just the importance of moths in Japanese history. I didn't really think about that at first when I was watching the movie and then doing a little bit more research about it. It's like, oh, that probably should have been a little bit more obvious. But, you know, silk, like, so first of all, Mothra is based on the wild silk moth. We see Mothra spitting silk from her mouth to destroy a helicopter at some point. And silk was a major commodity in Japan that was traded with the West for a very long time along the historic Silk Road, as it was known. So there's that connection. There's also the connection that moths feature very heavily in Japanese mythology. They're kind of seen as holy insects and guardian spirits that protect humans. So I, you know, just doing this research and realizing the very important cultural value that moths have in Japan. And obviously, like, the character of Mothra in this film as very benevolent, kind of, you know, destructive only to the extent that, like, she's just trying to, like, rescue her guardians, basically. You know, it all kind of connects to me. Like, it seems like Mothra definitely is meant to be, like, a symbol for Japan and, like, Japanese resilience and honor and things like that. That's how I read it, anyway.
Yeah, it's good to know. It's interesting because in my mind, the butterfly is the more noble species, and the moth is secondary. It's you know, uglier, if you will.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing maybe that's just like a cultural difference, because I didn't know that about moths in Japanese culture. And it totally makes sense now if that's where they're coming from.
Butterflies here are generally prettier than, because when I think of a moth, I usually think of like the annoying thing that hangs out around the light. Like, I don't, but I think of a butterfly, it's like, oh, it's so beautiful. But I mean, they're kind of the same thing, but yeah.
But if you look up some of these moths that Mothra is based off of, they are gorgeous with their coloration, and they are enormous insects. So of course they're awe-inspiring.
Well, we already discussed it a little bit, but it is a very bright, beautiful movie, especially the sequences on Infant Island. I mean, it feels like the Wizard of Oz or Willy Wonka kind of style, and it's beautiful. It's wonderful.
Yeah, that scene in particular with the vampire plants, it reminded me of something of the original Star Trek series.
Oh, sure.
This just seems like an alien planet.
Yeah,
because he's also in his radiation suit, which is like a space suit too. And it feels very science fictiony, but it's an island on Earth.
Yeah, all that stuff is so beautiful. And then, like, probably my other favorite scenes in the movie are the Shobijin's performances in the nightclubs in Tokyo. They're really bizarre. Like, we see this kind of, like, floating golden carriage, like, ascending over the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And just these, like, amazing close-ups of, like, I think it's Fukuda. He's watching in the audience. And there's an amazing close-up of his eyes as he's just, like, watching them on stage. Some of those scenes, I was like, this is... like pure cinema, you know, which I know sounds kind of like hyperbolic or whatever, but it's just like gorgeous. It's flawless.
No, there's that shot when the Shobijin's carriage crossfades, right? I think with Larva Mothra going through the ocean. I was like, I feel like I'm in a dream. It was beautiful.
And that's like what I wanted when I saw Ghidorah and the Mothra stuff was happening. And I was like, what the hell is going on? Like, I wanted that feeling when I watched this movie. And in scenes like that, I definitely got it.
Yeah.
I knew you'd like that, Matt.
Yes. the weirder, the better. I love it.
I was really taken by the direction. Again, some of the camera work in this film. It's interesting. It's visually entertaining. I really like the humor, and I like I mentioned the journalism aspect before, but there's also a gangster vibe too with Nelson and his cronies. And some of my favorite movies involve newspaper people and gangsters. So to put them in a monster movie, it was perfect.
I one thing that I loved the pacing of the movie. There were several moments where you were watching a sequence and the humans were talking, and then suddenly someone came in and was like, you know, have you heard? And they're like, oh yeah, I've heard, I'm watching this. And they're like, no, this happened. Like the way that it's like it flows very, very nicely. And there were several moments in here that I thought actually were where the humor actually worked. Like the whole part where, you know, he's hiding his face from the news, from being photographed and stuff like that. I thought it, and most of the rapport between the reporters, the reporter rapport, I thought there was a lot of humor that was actually done very well, and it actually, you know, translates pretty well.
The funniest scene I thought is when Fukuda, the reporter, is like single-handedly fighting off a gang of maybe like 8 or 10 henchmen or something. And at first you think he's going to like run away or something like that. But no, he just like, yeah, he fights all of them off. And he's like, this is why they call me the bulldog, you know? But no, for my good category, I don't really have too much to add there. I already talked about Mothra's song, which is, yeah, again, one of my favorite original songs from any movie ever, I would say, which I know sounds like an exaggeration, but I love it. What about the bad category? We can start with you this time, Ben.
Yeah, well, there is a bit of an elephant in the room when it comes to the natives, and it's not a good one. I mean, there's basically they're in blackface. Like, it's just, you know, I feel like their portrayal is a little bit better than the next year. You've got King Kong versus Godzilla, where it's even more, I'd say, racist and ridiculous. And you know, I know that's a service of the movie, but there is something about Nelson that's just so irredeemable and so ridiculous that's like kind of stretches credulity for me, even within the context of this movie. Like, just the fact that, like, the Relisican government would allow him to come back. Well, I guess they didn't know, but either way, like, it just seems like that's a bit of a stretch that he would do what he was doing and wouldn't eventually be like, oh, this is way too much. Like, what did he expect was going to happen when he got to Relisica? He was going to do another show there. Like, everyone was just going to forget that they destroyed a town in Japan. I mean, like, that to me was like a little bit too much.
Yeah, he's like the worst, arrogant, dumbest villain of like any movie that I can think of from this time, you know. But yeah, one thing I wanted to add about the natives in the film, which is definitely offensive and pretty inexcusable. Like, it's certainly the makeup, but also like just the primitivism of that culture. Like, I feel like if the movie had done anything at all to show like an actual culture and had not put them in blackface, but like shown, like, we do see like their language and their hieroglyphics, but beyond that, it's like they're not, we know nothing about them or like their arts or their culture or their society. Like, if the movie had given us just a little bit more, maybe it wouldn't be so offensive. But like, it really comes off about as poorly as possible, I think.
Yeah.
What didn't work for me at the end, what I find very confusing, is the sudden emphasis on Christian religion at the end of the movie. And it's obviously not a critique on Christianity, but its placement in this movie comes out of nowhere for me. Because it's like, there's like heavenly light, there's a swell of underscoring.
Yeah.
Is Honda trying to say something? But I mean, Mothra is obviously the godlike creature, but is there a relationship he's trying to draw a parallel to with Christianity? The movie doesn't explore that outside those last 5 minutes. And I'm like, why are we doing this?
Yeah. The only thing I can think of is given how much of this movie is a subtle, not so subtle indictment on Western culture, that maybe there was something. I think I'm not saying that it was handled well, but maybe he was trying to say that there are certain things that kind of transcend that, and spirituality is one of them. So, you know, drawing from consumerism bad, but any sort of belief that gives you faith and makes you a better human being, good.
I can see that.
Yeah, because that, you know, like the ending of the movie is also like a meeting between Japanese culture and the Infant Island culture, you know, which we don't know very much about. But like, I would buy that interpretation, because like, that's the moment when I think it's Chujo is like, well, he thinks back to the hieroglyphs and he's like, we can form a connection with Mothra, kind of. So I would buy that interpretation. Yeah.
I don't think it was done well, but I'll buy it.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Agreed.
All right. Last but not least, our campy category.
I think the scene in the very first Austin Powers, I think it's the first one, where the villains are just laughing for 20 minutes or whatever, just it never stops. That's ruined villainous laughter in movies for me forever. And there's a scene in this movie in particular when they get to Relisica and they hear on the radio that Mothra's been destroyed, and they're just, he like Nelson looks at one henchman and he's laughing, then he looks at the other one and he's laughing, and it's so over the top that it's, I mean, I loved it, but it's super campy, super ridiculous.
I remember that. My main campy also involves Nelson. At the end, right before he gets shot, he gets out of his car, right? And he's like, he's going through the crowds, and there's an old Caucasian man with a cane.
That's right.
Nelson knocks him over. Knocks the cane right out of his hands. The guy falls down.
Yeah. I loved that too. In case you were unclear if he was supposed to be the villain or not, like right. That settles it, you know?
Now he's crossed a line. Now he must die.
There yeah. He gets shot.
Yeah, immediately, pretty much. Yeah. Yeah, there was so one more campy moment I wanted to bring up just very, very quickly here. I think it's when Mothra the caterpillar is like swimming through the ocean, and like two guys, they seem to be in like a shack or something, see Mothra in the distance, and one guy turns around and he has a biscuit in his mouth, and then he sort of like shrieks and like falls out of the frame or something. It's actually kind of an intentionally funny moment, I think, but it's very ridiculous, pretty campy, I thought. All right. Well, we are pretty much at the end of the episode. One of the most exciting parts of each episode here on Camp Kaiju, where we give it our rating.
So we have four categories on Camp Kaiju. Our top tier ranking is it's a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. Our next one after that is there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and it does stand the test of time. Then it may be historically significant or just fun, but it ultimately doesn't stand the test of time. And then our last rating is it's not worth revisiting. It definitely does not stand the test of time. Ben, as our guest, we'll let you go first.
I think I came into this before I rewatched it and before we were discussing, I would have said timeless classic definitely stands the test of time. But given some of what we discussed, especially the natives in blackface, especially some of the more just problematic things, I would actually go with B. Maybe some antiquated moments, but overall it's great. It stands the test of time. I do think that it is incredibly historically significant, and everyone who is a fan of Japanese monster movies, especially, you need to watch it. But I'm not sure that I would put it in timeless classic category.
I actually feel the same way. I think that there are enough some dated moments and some effects that aren't as convincing for me that ultimately keep it from like a purely quote unquote perfect film. But with that said, it's an absolute must watch, should be on any kaiju fan's essential list. And it does stand the test of time despite those qualms.
I think all three of us are like-minded in this case. I totally agree with both of you guys. I just, you know, the things that you mentioned, some of the things that don't work so well, the outdated depictions, and also just the fact that I wish the reporter character was a little bit more compelling for me personally. But it's a very beautiful movie with so many like striking, strange, surreal moments, great music, very good, you know, model sets and suit work. Definitely stands the test of time, and for sure, you know, every kaiju fan should definitely make it a point to see Mothra. But if you're a kaiju fan, you probably already have, because it's a classic, so rightfully so. All right, thank you all so much for hanging out. If you liked what you hear, please tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and visit CampKaijuMovieReviews.com, Instagram, or Patreon for more monster movie content. Before I forget, Camp Kaiju is sponsored by BanditsEmporium.com, where you can shop exclusive monster-inspired t-shirts with part of the proceeds supporting this show. BanditsEmporium.com, hit the link in our bio. As they say, we sell shirts, and as Camp Kaiju says, we love Mothra. Thanks again, and thank you, Ben, for joining us. This was such fun talking about this movie.
Thank you. This is just an absolute blast.
The monster Mothra is dead.
Boss, boss, that's it. We're in. There's nothing to stop us.
Thanks, boss. What are you saying?